Thank you guys so much for coming. My name is Shang. If I have not met you yet, if you have not met me, my husband and I, we lead a small church plant in Brooklyn Center called ReChurch, and that's been fun. We're hitting 2 years in May, so coming right up here. Thank you. It's been fun. Any other church planters in the room? No, maybe, kind of. Okay, I see. it's been a lot of fun. And so I want you guys to know me. I want you guys to feel like it's a conversation between us and it's not just me talking at you. And so feel free to pause at any moment and ask questions if you have any questions. But I have for you the most recent family pictures we had. It's been maybe like 3 or 4 years since we've had a family picture because, as you guys know, it's hard to get all of them to look and smile. And so then we just said, we're not going to do it. And so they can all look and smile. And even then, this is the like two good pictures out of all of it. But from left to right, you have my oldest, Haven. She turned 10 this year. She is incredible, super artsy, but kind of chaotic. My youngest is Amara. So the two girls kind of sandwich the two boys. She is turning 4 in April, and she is a total sweetheart, but she is full of sass, as girls can be sometimes. And then off to the end here are my two boys, Ezekiel and Elias. And then my husband is in the center, Chuchi, if you guys have met him. I always joke that he is 5'2 with a 6'2 personality. And if you've met him, if you know him, that is not an exaggeration in any ways. And so that's a little bit about my family. For me, myself, I am bivocational. I work full-time in the marketplace. I've been in finance for the last maybe 10, 12 years. A good chunk of it in mortgage, and then the most recent chunk of it has been in equipment finance, risk management, and underwriting, and so forth. So it's been a lot of fun. Unlike a lot of people that I meet, I did not go to the NCU. I went to the U of M. Back in 2010. And so when I graduated out of high school, I went to the U of M. It was a beautiful campus. That was kind of what sold me. I didn't realize then how big the classes were and how not great that was for my introverted personality. But I was paying for it and I wanted to stick it through. So I went to the U of M, graduated from there in 2014, and never quite thought I would do a whole ton with my degree. So I graduated with a degree in sociology, specifically focusing on the intersection of race, class, and gender. And you fast forward these last 12 years, I would never have guessed that the world, our world, would be in the climate that it is today. And so it's kind of cool to see God bring that full circle, that though I'm not using it in the way that I thought I would use it, I am using it still for his glory. And so I did not give my life to Christ until I was 20. So I was midway through college already. And then from there, it probably wasn't until another like 5 or 6 years before I felt like I was really taking it seriously. I thought I was taking it seriously at 20. And then I got to about like 25, 26. And I was like, I was not taking it seriously. And so, you know, God does incredible things, and I am so grateful for his grace in these last many years. So that's kind of like a high-level Spark Notes version about me. Today we are going into talking about raising leaders cross-culturally. And I think I'm going to start at it hopefully kind of wide, and then we'll bring it down in a little bit more narrow. And then we'll talk through a couple of different things that I think is super helpful. But really, ultimately, I guess my goal for you guys is to leave you home with something to think about, something to go back home and say, God, like, what is that next step for me now that I have this information? What do you want me to do with it? How do you want me to take this back into my community, to my church, to my team, to my family, and so forth? And so with that being said, I thought the best place for us to start is Acts 2. That when you think of the local church, when you think of the body of Christ, Acts 2 is usually quoted as your goal to aspire to be like. So Acts 2:42 says that they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. And so this is kind of what we are all esteemed to mirror. And it's great. And so I want us to kind of start there. For those that maybe aren't as familiar or can be geographically challenged like I am, I have just a little map for you right here. So Jerusalem is here, and you see that as we go up in about the Paul's letters from Ephesus, Corinth, and so forth, as kind of this is where the gospel started, and then as it spread, and then here we are now. And so Luke, writing Acts 2 in about 60-ish AD, recorded the gospel through the beginning, the spread of the gospel from the beginning of the Mediterranean world, right? That he is noted for writing it with the Gentile audience in mind, to showcase that God has always intended the gospel to include the Gentiles. And then the book of Acts is then that bridge that kind of connects the gospels together into the letters of Paul. And so the four gospels, it entails the life of Jesus emerging into the Christian community, for lack of a better word, right? That he was there, he wrote, he died, resurrected, and then Acts 1 through 12 highlights kind of the ministry of Peter, while Acts 13 to 28 highlights the ministry of Paul. And I want to kind of focus in here that though we esteem to be like the Acts 2 church, the Acts 2 church was not yet a multicultural church. That we see in Acts 2, 5 through 6, it says that they were staying in Jerusalem. They're staying in Jerusalem where God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. That when they heard a sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard it in their own language being spoken. And so these were still Jewish people, that they may speak other languages, they may be from different regions, they were still the same people. And so as the early church continues to grow and spread throughout the Mediterranean world, the gospel is spread further and further into the rest of the Roman Empire, and this is where it becomes a collision of worldviews. Acts 2:42 tells you that, you know, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, that everyone was filled at awe, and that all the believers were together and had everything in common. And so as the gospel continues to go out farther and farther, the things we have in common doesn't feel like it's everything anymore. And so as we kind of go together, I wanted to just highlight very briefly an Eastern versus a Western worldview. That here for the Jewish people that are hearing the good news for the first time, and as they go outwards into the Roman Greco world, you have this difference of worldview. That the Eastern worldview is very much this cyclical or collective understanding. You can think of it kind of like a spiral. When we talk in the church about like our faith involving seasons, like this is a season of one thing and then we're going to go into a different season, same way that the seasons, they come and go, but they're cyclical, they'll come back around again. And ultimately kind of what defines it is that it's you believe first and then you understand. And as you go into the Roman Greco world, you enter into this Western worldview, that though it's not Western the way that we understand it now, this is kind of that beginning stages of what the Western worldview that we have kind of comes from. And that is that it's very linear. It's that one leads to two leads to three. It's very individualized, it's very rational, very logical. And here then is that understanding precedes faith. And I'm sure that many of you can think about even people or situations in your own church that unless they understand what you're teaching, it's hard for them to believe what you're saying. And that as you continue to grow in your walk with the Lord, and time again, even here at this conference, we learn that it is, you see the things that are not there yet. And as they come to pass, then you understand, God, what you are doing in the prior seasons. And so an example that you can think of this, that I think really highlights the Eastern worldview, is a lot of Jesus' parables are taught in that perspective. The main one that I want to highlight to you is when he speaks about the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son. That it's cyclical in that it's the same thing that he's highlighting, but he's highlighting them in three different ways. Does that make sense? And so why does this matter? Because in the same way that the early churches had to navigate this growing multicultural church, so do we. And I would argue that many of the issues we face today are still the same as what the Acts 2 church, the early churches had to go through. And so regardless of what our local church context is, we should impact the cities that we are in. And in order to impact the cities, I am a firm believer that our church demographic should look a little bit like the communities we are planted in. And so because of that, then we have to learn how to recognize and work through cultural differences in order to grow into a healthy, thriving church community like that of the Acts 2. And so my proposition for you guys is that it's not a question of if we will have these conversations, of if the church will be like this, but it's more so a matter of when. That even if you may be in a city context maybe it's more rural, maybe you don't have as much of a multicultural aspect to it, at some point, if not the kids that you are raising up or the future kids that they will bring in, that they will be sent out into the world where this is something that they will have to learn to navigate. And so our part as the leaders and as the teams and as the people that God has put in these communities, we do what we can to help them to see this. Even if we may not be directly impacted yet, we help them to see it so that as they go out, wherever it is that God sends them to in the future, that they will have this understanding. And so a couple of definitions that I want to throw out there so we're all speaking the same language, that we're on the same page when we're talking about this. And I don't want to assume that everyone knows the differences between any of these words, because they do often get used interchangeably. And so I want to kind of start at the biggest part of it, which is race. That race in itself is really kind of defined as each of the major groupings into which humankind is considered, in whether in various theories or contexts, and it's divided a lot of times based on the physical characteristics or shared ancestry. Any form you fill out, it'll ask you what your race is, and it'll list, you know, white, black, Asian, Hispanic, non-Hispanic, and that's kind of this big, broad umbrella. It is not always, but I would probably say oftentimes, it is associated to a lot of physical characteristics. And then that brings us to nationality, that this is a national status, specifically a legal relationship involving the allegiance on the part of an individual and usually protected on the part of the state. And so generally, nationality is bestowed by birth. However, there are some countries that as long as you're ancestry traces back to it, you are considered it. Jewish people, for example, fall into that. Japan does something like that. Ethnicity is then belonging to a particular ethnic affiliation or group. That ethnic groups are often a large group of people classed according to common racial, national, tribal, religious, linguistic, or cultural origin and background. And so the nation you are born of can sometimes be closely tied to your ethnicity, but it does not always mean that it's the same thing. For example, you can be born in Thailand and then you can also be Thai, right? That then your nationality is Thai and your ethnicity is also Thai. I can use myself as an example, that I was born in Thailand, but I am Hmong. So the nationality, if I don't have my citizenship, you would answer the question as that, yes, nationality-wise, it might fall under this umbrella of Thai, but I am specifically Hmong. However, because I am a citizen, my nationality is an American. Does that make sense? And then culture is really the beliefs, the custom, the arts, and et cetera, of a particular social group in a place or time. They have a shared set of attitudes, values, goals, practices that characterize an institution or an organization. And so from a sociological perspective, culture refers to the ways of life of the members of a specific society or a group within a society. And it includes the way that they dress, their marriage customs, their language, their family life, their patterns of work, and so forth. And we talk a lot about that in the church too, that as a church, as local churches, that we all have our own unique culture that we built into our churches. And then sometimes when you scale out of that, I've heard people say that, you know, well, I don't know if I really have a culture. And I would say that culture then, food for thought for you guys, is often the unspoken norms that define a community and is understood by the individuals. What do I mean by that? When people come into your church, do they hug and high five? That is a cultural part of your church. There are other churches that's not normal. You go in and you try to give them a high five and they might look at you like, why are you touching me? You know? Things like, this may not be a great example, but I'll share anyways. Some years ago, my husband and I, we were part of a church, and Chuji, his parents came to visit. And so after the service, he was having a conversation with his dad. You know, Chuji's probably, I think he was probably speaking in English, and then his dad responded back to him in Hmong. And then another a volunteer in the church came by, and I don't think she meant harm by this, but she came by and she says, oh, here we speak English. And this is the things that we don't talk about it, but they underline the way that we do things. And so whether you're in a church context or just in your own life, their culture is all around. It permeates everything that we do. And so I looked up some stats for us. This is from the 2023 census for Minnesota. We are broken down in having about 76% white. Black or African American is about 8%. American Indian, Alaska Native are about 1%. Asian is about 5%. Native Hawaiian, other Pacific Islanders, 0.1. Other races, about 2 to 3%. And then two or more races, so being biracial or more, is about 7%. And so you guys might have seen in my bio, in the workshop, I noted down that in Minnesota alone, we have access to the nations. We have over 5 million people from 1,000 different people groups. And so we don't have to wait to cross the sea to encounter different nations. We get the opportunity to do that right here. And so how many of you guys serve at your church in some capacity? Okay, that's a good chunk of you. I want you to take a look around this room and have an honest assessment. And then as you leave and you go to the rest of Equip, I want you to take a look around as well. How are we in Minnesota, as the Minnesota district, as leaders and servers on your church team, how are we representing the people that are here in Minnesota? That when you look around, you see our census reflected. That when you sit in the sanctuary and you look around, do you see us reflected of what this shows? Because my argument for you today is that if we are not looking like this to some degree, then there is a big chunk of people that we're missing. People in our community that need to hear the gospel, people that have never heard the gospel, or those that maybe they've heard, but they have no idea why it's important. And so in the church world, because I did not grow up in it, these last you know, decade and a half, what I've come to notice is that we can put a hyperfixation on overseas missions. And it's needed because they have zero exposure to the gospel, right? But we can't miss what God is doing here and why the local church is here. That there are people that are here in this country where you have the freedom to practice Christianity and you don't get persecuted for it. That you cannot have these conversations in a different country. So you have a different kind of privilege being here. And I want you guys to see that though it may not be as comfortable maybe talking to a Muslim about Christianity, you get the access, the privilege to have those conversations in a way that you can hear that those in the Middle East cannot. Do you get what I'm coming at? And so if we tie kind of some of these things together, right, I'll use myself as an example again, that if you look at the bigger, broader umbrella, racially, then you would consider that I am Asian. You can look at me and you can kind of tell, you know, she doesn't look black, you know? And that's okay to some extent. We as people are designed to categorize things. And so that's part of the way that our brains are wired. So racially, I am Asian. Ethnically, I am Hmong. Nationally, I am an American. But maybe as you build or as you dig deeper, culturally, I'm a millennial. That there are some things that I will say and do that's unique to being a millennial that Gen Z or Gen X may not have the same understanding. I just said earlier, I said I gave you guys the Spark Notes version of my bio. And for some of you, you guys get what I'm saying when I say Spark Notes. For other people in the room, you've never heard of what Spark Notes was at all. That's how I got through a lot of college. Just don't throw stones at me, okay? And so for each of you, I want you guys to also think about that for yourself, that when you break down the parts of your identity, what is different and what are the same things that we have? That I can take out millennial and I can put Christian. That me being Asian, Hmong, American, and Christian is different than someone that might be Asian, Hmong, American, and non-Christian. That our understanding and the way that we perceive the world would be slightly off. And so on the surface of culture are the things that are easily seen, and they are often the admired parts. And so you can think of it as an iceberg, right? That at the tip of the iceberg, you have things like food, flags, festivals, fashion, holidays, music, dances, games, language, literature, arts and crafts. These are things that you can go out and you'll see, and we can see that they are beautiful. Beneath the iceberg, the thing that got the Titanic in trouble is the deeper parts of culture. These are the areas that then we can collide and we can run into struggles with sometimes. Is that here, these are the drivers of a community's culture, whether that be your church community or a people group's community. Some examples here is communications, styles, and roles. What are their facial expressions like? What are their gestures? Do they make eye contact? What do they think about personal space? How do they feel about touching? Body language, conversational patterns, the handling and displaying of emotions, the tone of voice. It also goes into their notions of what is courtesy? What does manners look like? What does friendship look like? What constitutes being a leader? What is beauty? What is modesty? And then also then ideas of time. What does time look like for some people? What does past and future look like? What is fairness? What is justice? Who gets to make those determinations? How do roles relate to each other when you think about age and sex, class, and family? That for me, being raised up Hmong, in a very traditional Hmong household, when we go to family events, I don't shake hands with men, and they don't shake hands with me. And so coming into the church world, if you were to come to me and shake my hand, my default reaction is to kind of not want to do it, and it's taken years to unlearn that in some contexts, it makes sense. to be respectful of the people. And in other contexts, it would not make sense. And then even deeper still, that as we go, what are their attitudes towards elders, adolescents, dependents? What are the rules and expectations? How do they perceive work, authority, success, cooperation versus competition, relationship with animals, with people, age, sin, death, courtship, marriage, children, raising children, decision-making, problem-solving? These are even deeper still to all of that. And I'll give you guys an example. Some years ago, we were driving on the highway, and Chuji and I, we like to guess when new buildings are being built to see what they're going to be. Sometimes we'll try to guess if it's going to be a hotel, if it's a new apartment, if it's a, you know, new retail infrastructure. And we passed by one where after some months, it ended up being an elderly senior care home. And Chuji goes, why would they build that? Because for us, it's just expected. It's just normal that when your parents age, they live with you. And if you need help, you bring help into the home, but you don't send your parents out of the home. That if they spent their early years raising you, the least that we can do is spend our later years caring for them. So it's not normal. So we could have a conversation with someone else where maybe sending the elderly to a senior home is the right choice. And it's not that it's a right or a wrong choice, it's just that it's different. That the way that we're raised to see family and to see elders is different. And so as we continue to go, I want to specifically focus on culture because this is kind of where the distance feels the biggest. That it feels the biggest, and I think it's here that often we need to build the bridge. And as believers, as church leaders, as people that serve in your church community, it is on us to make the first step to do this. We can't expect the world to bring themselves to us. And in that, you know, I'm going to wait until there's a perfect moment to talk to someone that, God, you will literally bring someone different than me to come talk to me, but that I have to be intentional on stepping out and talking to them. And so the beautiful thing is that all of these different cultural aspects, they blend together to make us unique individuals. That if God could have made us all the same, he would have found ways to make us all the same. If he wanted us to all look and speak and act the same, he would have. But the fact is that he didn't. And if he didn't, the culturally, not from a church culture perspective, but overall as broad people groups, it's not something for us to try to snuff out per se, but it's that how do we keep the things that are beautiful about these people, and then how do we help them walk into kingdom culture at the same time? And so this is why the workshop is called Leading in the Deep, that it's the deep part of culture that we have to dig into, that these are the parts that when conflict arises, can we look at what's driving it and not assume that maybe they're late because they're just late. I talked about time earlier, and I know some of you guys laughed because to some people, time is very different. Monk time is very different. You might say your event starts at 2, and 2 is a suggested arrival time. You know, will we eat at 4 or at 6? Who knows? Whenever the food is done cooking and everyone is there, that's when we start. This is different though. In the church, we can't have a suggested start time. Service starts at 10, it starts at 10. Whether you're here or not, the show must go on. And so when you're talking to people, and if they're used to showing up on time, like Hmong people time, then sometimes we can think that, oh, they're just not diligent. They just don't want to show up. They're just late. They don't have their priorities in order. When really it's a whole cultural shift of walking with them, That again, in some contexts, that makes sense. In other contexts, like, let's walk together. And okay, maybe it's not easy to show up on time. But how can I help you to be able to get here? And why do we value that? Why do we do it this way? And so I have three things that I want to give to you for the last bit of our time together. And then I'll give an explanation after why I put it this way. So as you're reaching out to people, right, maybe the question is, well, what do we do? How do we do this? How do we make this into a practical thing? And I would say number one is to start with a common ground. That verse 44 says that all the believers were together and they had everything in common. And I would encourage you to start with someone that looks different or thinks different than you. And that if they are already a part of your church, you can ask them about their story. Ask them about how they got here in terms of how they found your church, what God has done in their life. If they are not part of your church, find a common interest. Do they like sports? Do they have hobbies? What stage of life are they in? And then if you can't think of anyone, then maybe that's part of the problem. That there are places that I go, people that I meet, and they can't name a single person that is not in the same bucket as them. And I think, again, we're missing a big part of the picture, is that if as a church leader, right, our city has, we're kind of evenly distributed between white, black, and then Hispanic and Asian. So it's kind of like a third each in our city demographic. If you came to my church and you asked me, Shane, do you know a single black person? And if I told you no, would you not be concerned in some way? That how are you in a city where a third of your population is black and you don't know a single person? How would you know to talk to them? How would you relate to them if you don't even go out of your ways to connect with them? If all of my friends were Hmong, or if all of our church is Asian. And the thing is, I don't want to discredit, because birds of a feather, they do flock together. Because we are Asian and we are a young family, statistics show us that those that will be most natural to gravitate towards our church are probably young families and Asians, because we're in the same season of life that they are in. So that in itself, it's not a bad thing, but it's to recognize that because that is kind of the default attraction, how do I put in the steps to go above that, to go beyond that, to not just limit to, these must just be the people that you're bringing in, but it's to be intentional that, God, we're missing people here. There are people that need to be in these chairs that are not here right now. So how do we go out and help them to come in to be a part of this local church? We're called a local church for a reason, right? We're not called a lone wolf church. We're not called a standalone church. We're not called anything else but that we are a local church for the local community. Which is why, as a pin note, that online services are great. I think it's helped to speed the gospel in great ways. But even then, our encouragement is always to be find a local church community. Those are great for Monday through Saturday if you want some additional substance. But you need to be plugged in into a community that is where you are, that you can be plugged into small groups, to life groups, to youth, to young adults, whatever, you name it. And so all the believers here, they had something in common. Whether it's hobbies, whether it's, sometimes we can look at this and we can think, well, that doesn't apply to the church though. Like as a believer, I don't want to just be limited to finding people that look like me, or like, I don't do that. Like I don't just go out and be like, I'm going to purposely talk to someone that looks like me. But I would even say, how many of you guys have walked into rooms where you don't know if anyone is a believer, and then when you hear that someone goes to church, you kind of gravitate towards that. And you want to know, like, hey, where do you go to church? How long have you been a believer? That even when I go to my kids' school events, if I overhear that a parent is talking to their kids about, like, hey, we have to go to church after this, there's a part of me that wants to know, like, oh, there's another believer here in this room. And we gravitate towards that. And so again, if there's anything to take away from this one, is that the things that we gravitate towards, they're not bad things, but it's to recognize it and then decide, what are we going to do to go beyond this? So finding a common ground with the people that are in your community. And then number two is that it'll cost you convenience and comfort. Verse 45 says that they sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had a need. And I've heard it said a lot in recent months from upcoming and current leadership and serve teams that, like, well, you know, Shane, like, I just don't have the capacity. Like, you want me to meet every single person? I'm going to be burnt out. I'm going to be too tired. My schedule is already so packed. I don't have the time. But the reality is that if through all of this and you end here feeling like, well, I guess I just have to do it, then I would say you're missing the point too. That it's never a we have to do this, but it is that we get to partake in what God is doing, and it is a privilege to be able to do this. It is a privilege to be able to walk down the block and see someone that did not grow up the same way that I did, that doesn't look like me, and I can talk to them. And then number three, table fellowship for the long haul. 46 says that for every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts. And it sounds simple, but the weight of it is significant because food is the uniter of people. It really is. And going out to dinner is great, but I think that there is something so special about inviting people into your home and sharing a meal with them. That it is one of the easiest ways, but time-costly ways, to invest into a relationship. I'll give you guys a story. Where I work at, my boss, he is remote from California. He flies up every so often to, you know, touch base, to kind of gather with the company, and then he'll fly back home. And so a couple of months ago, he came up and he was like, hey, Shane, we should go grab lunch because it's your work anniversary. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then all of a sudden, in the back of my head, I'm like, who's driving us though? Like, you don't have a car, and I have a car, but I have a minivan with four kids, you guys. There is probably cereal in there that has been there from who knows when. And so what did I do? I told him, like, okay, it makes sense. I'm the one that has the car. We can go in my car. We invited a couple of other people. But then even just inviting them into my car was this big, like, oh my gosh, like, what if they judge me? Like, what if he sees my, you know, all the crumbs on my floor? What if he sees the random stickers or footmarks on the back of my chairs or the handprints? Parents, you know, all the handprints on the window. And if you're unlucky, maybe a couple of kiss marks on the window, you know? And so what did I do? I went and I cleaned out my whole car because I wanted to make a good impression for my boss who's coming out of town to step into my car. And you guys, it was only my car. That wasn't even my house. You know, it was only my, could you imagine, I'd probably swipe down and clean my whole house. But I think that sometimes we can get self-conscious about inviting people into the privacy of our homes because that's supposed to be a safe place for us, that when we invite them in, they have access to our kids. And in current climate, that makes a lot of us very nervous. In the world of social media and TikTok, when everything is neatly polished and put together and everything matches and it meshes together, we can look at that and be like, well, my house doesn't look like that at all. And I'll just be honest, Trudy and I, we've gotten to a point where we tell people, we have four kids, you guys. Our house is gonna look like what it looks like. You see crumbs under the sofa, just leave it. We'll get to it in 7 to 10 business days, okay? Laundry is never ending. Our sink always has dishes. We wash the dishes, but kids will have a way of continually putting dishes in there. And so I say all of this because it opens up vulnerability, that when we are vulnerable to the people around us in a simple way as inviting them into our home to share a meal, we create a safe space for them to invite us into their homes, into their lives, into their hearts. But if we can't even open up our physical space, how do we expect that they will open up their hearts to what we have to say, to what the church is doing, to who God is? And so a thought as we're wrapping up here, I have maybe like two things left for you guys. A thought that I want to leave you with is that reaching the next generation of leaders cross-culturally, it cannot be mass-produced, it is handcrafted. After I held this at the Bridging the Gap Women's Leadership Retreat, and I had a lot of people that came up and say, hey, how do you put this into a system? How do you make this into a system that we can teach our team? And I want to tell you, systems are great. I love systems. I love order and to-do lists and stuff like that. But these types of relationships, they are handcrafted. They cannot be mass-produced. There is not a, okay, here's steps 1 through 5, and if you do all these things, that's great, you are in that community, and it's beautiful. And so I think that sometimes our struggle as churches is that we love the leaders that can hit the ground running and be able to disciple and understand the Bible. They have biblical foundations, they have the right worldview, and we're like, we can just plug you in, and you can be a small group leader, you can be a youth leader, you can be whatever leader for all the different teams we have. And the thing is that for the people that you will reach that are in your community, a lot of them will have never made a decision like this before. And I'm not saying that there are people that have made this commitment and understand, but I will say that there are some people groups where Christianity has never existed. Their family, they've never known what this is. They don't know what syncretism is. They don't know what a lot of these things are, and so it's gonna take time and individual investment into individuals. And that though I may not speak Spanish, I may not know a whole ton, but I can do what I need to do to be able to at least connect with one person and then empower one person to reach their persons. Do you see what I'm saying? And so the long haul, H-A-L, because there is always room for one more. That at any time you feel like this is enough people, there is always room for one more. When you feel like you've reached enough people groups, there is always room for one more. And then you do it for the actual long haul. That for all of eternity, for as long as we live, this is our heart. That missions is not just an external thing out there, but missions is in our community as well. Amen. And then I want to close with a story. This is a map. If you guys are big movie people, or not a map, a picture, if you guys can see it. We are big movie people. Chuchi loves movies. I'm okay with them. If the storyline is good, I'll enjoy it. This is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. If you guys, anyone Marvel fans? DC fans? Okay, a few. This is the lineup of all of the Marvel movies that have come out. When you look back, Iron Man came out in 2008, actually. 2008, and we are in 2026, a whole almost 20 years. Iron Man came out, The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2 in 2010, Captain America in 2011, The Avengers, the first Avengers movie in 2012. And since then, 30 movies and counting have been released of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But in 2021, something a little different happened. And Marvel released a movie called Shang-Chi. Right there, if you can see it. And something shifted. Because my son, at this point, he was 4. And he saw someone that looked like him. And in his head, he goes, hey, he's a superhero too. And then he became obsessed with Shang-Chi for probably a whole year. We probably watched it maybe 7 times a day, every waking moment. And he loved it. And when I asked him, he says, it's because, Mom, he looks like me. Doesn't matter that Shang-Chi is Chinese and he's not Chinese to him, it's just he looks like me. And I think that in the church, when our teams and when our church, when they only look like us, sometimes people come in, they're like, hey, I don't know if I belong here because there's no one that looks like me. And so if a slight shift that after, so 2008 to 2021 is what, 10, my math is not great, 10 some years. And it took one superhero for my kid to be like, hey, I can be a superhero too. Spider-Man was great. He loved Spider-Man. But he loved Shang-Chi with all his heart. And so multicultural, multi-ethnic leaders, they don't start out there, but they start in here. They start with us having our heart for that. It starts with us saying that though we can't reach the whole group, we can reach one person. And we can talk to one person. And we can get to know their story and remember their story. That's the key part. If you know their story, but you know, 2 weeks later, you're like, wait, remind me again? What? To them, what they hear is, oh, you didn't really care. You asked, but it didn't actually sit with you. That we can't raise multicultural leaders if we don't connect with multicultural, multi-ethnic people. And so if you serve in any capacity in your church, in big ways or in small ways, I'll say it to you like we say it in our church, which is that tag, you are it. And so be in the middle, dive all in, go deep with the people, get to know the ins and outs of why they do what they do, why they believe what they believe, or why they don't believe, why they have trouble understanding maybe things like communion or communion's a great example because bread is not a staple food in a lot of people groups. So you can explain to them that Jesus is the bread, and for people like me, I'll keep using myself an example, where I don't even eat bread ever unless I'm feeling bread. Bread is not a big deal. But if you told me Jesus is kind of like rice, I get you. I have that at every meal, okay? As a joke. And so tag, you're it, set the example, lead by example. So that whether it's here, there, or everywhere, that the missions-hearted leader is not just about overseas, but it's here in your local community as well. And so I don't know how much time we have, but if we have questions, we can maybe take a couple and then 10 minutes. Okay, perfect. So we have 10 minutes if you guys have any questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
So that last part about starting with the looking at your church and the tag here.
Yes. Yeah.
We have in our community a lot of different cultures,
mm-hmm.
And they're close cultures to the unreached people groups mm-hmm. in our community.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how do we mobilize, after mobilizing those close cultures mm-hmm. to that unreached people group, to help them not get caught up with any prejudice that might be given to them by that unreached people group to keep them going and not mm-hmm. like just give up because, oh, well, there's this prejudice that might be happening between, for example, Liberians and Somalians.
Mm-hmm. I would say to that it's twofold in that helping our church members and our teams to understand that it's first and foremost a Great Commission. That we have to have that as the foundation as to why we do what we do, because if the Great Commission is not the foundation, then we'll find any reason to not want to connect with people. So it has to be that, God, we're reaching people because, Lord, you have a heart for those people. And though my heart might still need some sorting out, I'm going to submit my heart back to God, what you are doing. And so that in itself is a heart posture issue that we continue to walk with people on. And I would say that I think if you have maybe team members or people in your church where it's just like maybe they're still really hostile towards certain people group, where maybe they've had bad experiences, maybe they've heard things on the news or whatever, and their prejudice is just overwhelming, that may not be the person to send out just yet. That's the person that, hey, let's work on that heart posture. Let's understand, why do we reach people? Why do we do the Great Commission? Why do we share the good news and work on that first? And then when they do go out, then though there might be some tension between the preconceived notions of where they came from and the new people that they're reaching, at least they have that as a foundation to continue to press you, that even when it gets hard, God, we keep moving forward. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so I would say that is the first and foremost, that if we don't have that in order, then the rest of this, it's going to be that much harder to help people to see why we do this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What you were saying, though, I think there's another level to that. Mm-hmm. And at first, that's what I thought you were asking, is that the people you bring in, mm-hmm. they're unchurched,
uh-huh.
not comfortable with the other people that are in the church.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that's where you were headed.
Yeah.
But I really believe when you have a spirit-filled church, and you, like you said, you train them, this is how you love, this mm-hmm. is how you ask, this is how you understand.
Mm-hmm.
When they see you responding
yes.
that way, it has a huge impact.
Yes.
You know, and I believe that covers
yes.
a lot of that tension that comes in, like, oh, you got these guys in your church, well, I'm not coming here anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, well, wow, they really love each other.
Yes.
You know? And that just, I think that is a blood covering.
Yes.
Over those insecurities that people bring
yeah.
into this.
I think that kind of comes into, like, that we lead by example, right? That it is the love of God that draws people to repentance. And so when we continually walk that out, that it's, of course, we can take offense. That maybe someone will come in and be like, oh, you know what? I just don't like Asian pastors. It's no different than someone else coming in and saying, I don't like women pastors. We continue to love them anyways. And we tell them, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm not the right, this is not the right church for you. We're not everyone's cup of tea, but crucial is for you to know as leaders in your church how to connect them to somewhere else. That if they come in, they're absolutely like, I absolutely cannot grow in here. I want to know God, but your church and you have these people and I cannot be here. Then know your ethnic churches, know your ethnic pastors. If you can't name a single ethnic pastor that's part of the district here, get to know them, figure out who they are. And so if, for example, we have a family where the son, he really likes coming. He's 16, speaks English and Spanish. His mom doesn't speak a lick of English. That's okay. You know what? We know pastors. We know other Spanish-speaking churches. Let me help plug you into the right church. And that kind of combats that, like, competitiveness that can sometimes happen in the church world, where we want them to stay in our church and we want them to be a part of our people. But it's not about our church. That as long as they are in a local church, a Bible-believing church, then God can do whatever he wants to do in their life there. And so if they don't like my church, that's okay. Chuji is kind of loud. That's just the way it is. You want a Hmong-speaking church? I know tons of Hmong-speaking church. You want a Hispanic church? I know churches. You want a church that is, you know, more out in the rural boonies? I know a church. And so for us, is though, if you can't offer those services, if you can't do it on your own team or in-house, then know the resources of where to connect them to. In the same way that maybe your church does not provide food shelf options for your people, you know a food shelf that you can connect them to. You may not offer medical services, for example, but you know a service. Know the other local churches that do maybe serve more of these people group. And if that's where they need to start so that God can work on their heart and God can impact them, you know what? By all means, we're still winning. At the end of the day, we're on the same team. We're running the same race. We're doing the same thing. So thank you. I appreciate that. Yes, in the back.
I had a question about when you have people of different cultures come in and say they get saved for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
We live next to a reservation. And uh-huh. I've had someone ask me, you know, like, they're following Jesus for the first
yeah.
time, and a lot of their culture is intertwined with, like, religion.
Yes.
And
yep.
I'm wondering, like, can I not go to powwows anymore? Or, you know, and I was like, honestly, I feel like it has a lot to do with heart posture.
Yeah.
But I was like, how do you disciple? Like, I realized when she asked me that question,
yeah.
I was like, wow, I'm not equipped to know how to, like, don't reject your culture.
Yeah.
Maybe follow Jesus. So,
like, yes.
How do you navigate?
Yeah, that is a very valid point. There are a lot of people groups that their religion and their culture are kind of meshed together, and it's really, really hard to pull the two apart. And so in that, something that we've tried really to be intentional on is to remind people that you can be present. And I think that sometimes the disconnect when people come in is that, well, if I follow Jesus, then I just need to cut off all these people, and I can't. This is my mom. This is my dad. These are my cousins. So the point is that we're not asking you to cut off everything in your community. And if there's a faster way to get a distaste of Christianity into that community, it is you cutting that whole community off. And so it's reminding them that you can be present. For a lot of people, presence matters more than anything. And so if there are aspects of what they're doing that maybe has more spiritual backing to it, then I think in that, then it's discipleship. That let's talk through some of these things, like help me to understand what's going on at this event that you want to go to. Are there spiritual aspects of it that we need to address? And then from there, you know, unless God is really convicting that person, like you should not go, go with the conviction, go with what God is saying. But if there's not a conviction and they're just unsure, then just let them know they can be present. And presence does not mean that they are idol worshiping, because I think sometimes that's kind of the switch, is that if you're there, then you're obviously worshiping the idol. There's a lot of people that come to church, vice versa, that don't worship God. So you can be present in there to show the light of the world in a place that is all darkness, and love and care. And again, coming back to that, we lead by example. That as you continue to love, as you continue to be there, as you offer to pray for people, get to know them, that it is the love of Christ that draws them to repentance. And so it just cracks open the door. But if we shut the door and we're like, just don't go, then it shuts everything down. And so, yes.
Kind of a specific one.
Yeah.
So we've done a bit of outreach to the Hmong community,
mm-hmm.
like the Hmong ABC and the Hmong Village, and
stuff. Mm-hmm.
I've done my best to try and learn as much as I can about the culture and the language, but I can only hear four tones. I know there's eight. I can only hear four. I can say Yesu Luka, and that's I wondered if you could speak to some specific like cultural sensitivities that we could navigate around to avoid, you know, causing offense and hardening hearts, you know.
Yeah. I think kind of tying it back to the last one, calling anything demonic is a quick way for people to shut down. So though we understand that, they don't understand that yet. So whether that's their religious like rituals or things like that, if you tell them off the bat that like, hey, that's demonic, they're gonna be like, you just hate me. They may not say that out loud, but I think that's kind of the inner voice that goes on, like, oh, you're telling me I'm from like the devil. Like, you're telling me that like my family is gonna go to hell. That's the kind of like internal back end thoughts that they kind of grow through. And so in that, it's helping them to understand what is of God. What is of God, and so going at it from more of that direction and not just diving into that like it's demonic or it's whatever. And then I think specific to the Hmong community, and actually maybe to all communities, is understanding who has the biggest influence in that community. There are some communities, some people groups that may be going through, like kids are a great way. In the, you know, more American Western mindset, they tell you all the time, if you can win the kids, you'll win the family. In some communities, that's not the case. You can reach the kids and their parents are gonna be like, you're trying to steal my kids. And so understanding who has the biggest influence there, and then how do we work towards connecting a bridge to that person or to those leaders or whatnot. So whether that's like that it's the dad figures in the home or the mom figures, or maybe it's clan leaders or whatnot. Like how do we, you can build a relationship with kids, but the kids is you build relationships with them, and then you extend the relationship farther to reach the people that do make those key decisions. Does that make sense? So I would say anything regarding spiritual aspects, going hardcore on it is a quick way to shut it down. Other things are really understanding and helping those people to see that embracing and accepting Jesus is not a denial of their cultural background. And I think that's also sometimes we can feel like, well, now that I've said yes to God, I have to say no to being a part of you know, being Hmong or being, you know, Hispanic. That it feels, for whatever reason, it feels like we need to sever that when that's not the case at all. And so helping them to like embrace that, like God's calling you into this new identity, but he will work out this part of you too, that part is so good and it's not meant to hold you down. If that makes sense. But we can definitely talk more if you have specific questions.
Do you have an email maybe that you can share? And if you guys have questions, specifically, this has been amazing, and she's got lots of information and resources. So If she could share her email, maybe you guys could reach out to her individually and ask some questions, and maybe you'll leave and think of something after you leave and be like, oh, that would be a good question.
Yes.
So thank you so much.
My phone number, email is up there. I have a QR code for feedback. I wasn't sure if I wanted to keep this up. So if you do give me feedback, be gentle with my feelings. My feelings are kind of fragile. Just kidding. But if there are ways that you feel like, you know, what can be added on or taken out to make this more beneficial, or hot button type questions that you want to be able to hear the next time, I would love that. But otherwise, my email, my phone number, you're welcome to email or text me, and I'll try to respond back. And if I don't, I have kids. They'll open the text messages. Just text me again anyways. And I promise you, I will get to it. Thank you. Thank you, guys.